You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Steve.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, and hope you're doing well, too.
I'm doing fine. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Stephen Macedo, and you're a political scientist at Princeton.
Yes.
And you're acting director of the Center for Human Values.
Yes.
Where I actually had a one-year fellowship Lodi's many years ago. It was a very valuable year. You were, at that point, you were director. It sounds like you've gotten a demotion for some sort of misbehavior.
I'm filling in for...
Or is it the other way around, right?
Well, I'm filling in for a colleague on leave. I did two terms, and that was good. And No, I remember having you here very well, and we miss you and hope that we can get you back for some events, you know, before long.
I'm available. I'm not in demand.
Well, I'll make sure of that, yeah.
Okay. So, listen, you have, among other things, written a very interesting book that's gotten a lot of attention called In COVID's Wake, How Our Politics Failed Us, in which you call into question some of the, I guess, wisdom of some of the policies that prevailed in America during COVID and how well informed they were or weren't by available data. And you call attention to some negative consequences of some of the policies. And I'm interested in all that, want to get into it. I'm also interested in the kind of psychological dynamics and political dynamics that can get in the way of clear thinking in a situation like that. You also, and I want to get into this a little, you get a little into the scientific establishment's messaging about the origins of COVID, lab leak or whatever. It's a little tangential to your main argument, but you get into it. It's very interesting. I think we should say, you know, up front, you're not an anti-vaxxer. You would affirm that the vaccines lowered the mortality rate very significantly, leaving aside the question of the extent to which they slowed transmission. There's no doubt that people who got the vaccine had a significantly lower chance of dying. You mainly are focusing on what you call non-pharmaceutical interventions, right? And what does that cover?
Well, we should also just mention my excellent co-author, Francis Lee.
I'm
but
sorry.
That's quite right. All right.
Who was also a political scientist at Princeton.
Absolutely.
Francis Lee.
Absolutely. Colleague in politics. Absolutely. So the non-pharmaceutical interventions cover everything except drugs and vaccines. And, you know, it turns out that they had been studied for quite a long time, the possibility of implementing non-pharmaceutical interventions in the event of a pandemic. So, border closures, contact tracing, school closures, quarantines, masking, social distancing requirements of all sorts to try to reduce transmission and mortality. So the whole suite of measures that were mandated in many cases in advance of drugs and vaccines. You know, one of the things that was really interesting was to go back to, 2005, really, when the study of these things was initiated by President George W. Bush, who read John Barry's The Great Influenza about the 1918 flu pandemic, and who became, you know, concerned about the inevitability of a future pandemic. I think some bioweapons concerns might have been in the air there, too, in the wake of 9/11. But he initiated a significant study process of the possibility of these sorts of interventions. What we found was that there's a bunch of mathematical modelers who remained influential at the beginning of COVID, who were optimistic about these measures, based on projections. Michael Lewis also writes about them in his book, The Premonition, which is his study of the pandemic. He's very positive about them. I think he treats them kind of like the Moneyball guy in the baseball movie, with the name of which I'm forgetting. But
it's based on his book. I think it's called Moneyball. It's based
that's
on
right.
his book.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course. Yes. But in that case, I think that guy had a lot of data based on on-base percentages and the mathematical models. In this case, a lot of it was speculation. But in any case, they saw, you know, just school closures by themselves as leading to, as they said in one document, a 50% reduction in peak death rates. So they were extremely optimistic about the possibility of limiting respiratory virus through these measures. Others were not convinced, including the National Institutes of Medicine commissioned a report, Dr. Adel Mahmoud, who was here at Princeton in the policy school in the 90s and early 2000s. And he commissioned a group to look at these measures and consider whether the evidence supported their predicted effectiveness, and expressed skepticism, considerable doubt, and also emphasized that the measures would be very costly, that keeping schools closed, attempting to contact trace, border closures and other measures, closing down the economy, would have not just economic but well-being impacts. And in fact, the other thing that they said in this 2005 letter report on these measures was that it was extremely important for public health officials and scientists to communicate the weak evidentiary basis for these measures to the public and the certainty of their costs, especially because in the event of a crisis, public health officials might well resort to these in order to show they were in charge, that they had things under control, that they were taking tough measures. So they might be, led to implement these measures on political grounds, as it were, rather than on public health grounds. So that 2005 letter was really quite prescient. And we talk about a whole series of follow-ups, you know, World Health Organization report on NPIs that came out in November 2019, just a few weeks before the pandemic, and said, that the evidence to support these measures was weak, costs would be high. And in fact, they said that there were certain measures that were not recommended under any circumstances, and that included border closures, contact tracing, quarantine of exposed individuals, and one other that I'm forgetting offhand now, but things that we implemented on a broad scale across the world.
Can I interrupt you there?
Please.
I think some people had speculated, and it had made sense to me, that the WHO's position on border closings had partly to do with the feared consequences of border closings, especially on nations, I mean, say in the global south, where pandemics sometimes arise, and if you turn, if you turn a country into kind of a pariah, you can kind of choke their economy. I mean, it always seemed to me that in principle, border closings, if done early enough, could keep a pandemic from entering your territory. Does that resonate at all?
No, that's fair enough. And under the right circumstances, implemented extremely early, that might be the case. Mm-hmm. The way that there was a UK government, planning document on this in 2011, and it emphasized that, the conditions of the global economy with air travel and globalized commerce and so on, this would generally be extremely hard to pull off.
Right.
That it's one thing to isolate one country, a foreign country, say, when it's not you, but more generalized border closures to try to keep it out of your country might not be possible to do, especially once it starts to spread. I mean, with COVID itself, we really, it may well have originated in the fall of 2019. There's at least some evidence to that effect. It certainly was traveling, around the world in December, and certainly in this case, the closures were undertaken, it seems, too late. So under some circumstances, that might be the case. But as a general matter, with respiratory viruses, it was generally not recommended. This is what's in the WHO report then, and Johns Hopkins just earlier that year as well. For these general lockdowns to take place around the world, I mean, the public has to be convinced, that this is a serious threat. And, by the time that happens, the virus is liable to be traveling. So, ideally, if one implemented very, very early, it is possible. But the skepticism was based on the notion that that might well not be possible.
Now, it became evident pretty early on that we were going to experience the thing in the United States regardless. So now, you know, I guess maybe my job is to play devil's advocate here, and maybe you'll agree with some of the things I say. I mean, the first thing is, obviously, at the beginning of this pandemic, we didn't know much about it. I know one of the things you think was overdone, and this makes sense to me, actually, is school closures. But, you know, it wasn't so clear at the very beginning that this was a pandemic that just doesn't afflict children at a very high rate. Some do, right?
Yeah.
But this one didn't. And in general, we were learning about it kind of slowly. As you note in the book, very early on, China did a lockdown that seemed effective in Wuhan. Of course, you can ask, is it possible for the U.S. for political and cultural reasons to do the kind of lockdown that China can do?
Right.
Very good question.
Yeah.
But anyway, you had that example where a pretty draconian policy seemed to work. I guess part of the question is, how defensible do you think the policies are, like, at various points? How does defensibility change over time?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. And, you know, focus on school closures. You know, Mike DeWine, I think, was the first one to close the schools in the country, in Ohio, around March 10th, I think, 2020. I think that was the first statewide school closures. And, you know, Republican and Democratic states pretty uniformly closed schools across the country in early to mid-March. And likewise, you know, across much of Europe, not everywhere. The Swedes never closed their schools for kids under 16. I think Iceland never closed its schools. Of course, it's an island nation and so on. But there were widespread school closures in Europe as well early on. And so I think the crucial thing, and you're right, I mean, we don't know much about it. We didn't know the details and so on. So, you know, fair enough. But the Europeans started reopening their schools in April and May. I'll mention another book, by the way. I shouldn't be selling other people's books on your podcast, but David Zweig, An Abundance of Caution. His book came out about a month after ours. And it's also a terrific book, I would say, complementary to ours, that focuses on school closures. Anyway, one of the things that he points out is that, you know, by April and May, European schools had been open. In May, I think it was May 8th, 2020, the European education ministers put out a report saying the schools are open. It appears that they're not transmitters of the disease. Republican states started reopening, some of them, in the spring of 2020. We did learn in the first few months that schools were not significant transmitters of disease, and also that teachers didn't seem to be at greater risk. So I would say certainly by the summer of 2020, we knew enough to have good evidence, I think, that schools could be safely reopened, which they did generally in Europe in the fall of 2020, and they did generally often in Republican states. But it was politics. And the other thing that seems very clear now, we cite work by Michael Hartney at Boston College. I think as a subsequent article with a colleague, Leslie Finger, you know, they find that the drivers of the school closures, the length of the school closures, was not the virulence of the virus, but rather the strength of teachers' unions and the percentage Democratic vote for president. So I think it was in some significant part driven by politics. And in answer to your question, I think with respect to school closures, there's much that we could have learned in the late spring of 2020, which just didn't get learned, didn't even become part of the conversation. Again, one of the things that Zweig finds as well is that coverage in the American media of news around COVID was much more uniformly negative than it was in Europe. There was a CDC report that came out, I think it was in April, which had both good news and bad news. The bad news was that males were at more risk than women, and that African Americans seemed to be at more risk than Caucasians. But the good news was that kids seem to be at very low risk, and this is April 2020. And what he finds is there was major coverage in the American press of the bad news, but there was virtually no coverage, you know, of the good news. So the press, I think, was significantly responsible for the tone of the coverage, and for the unevenness of the information that was conveyed, and that contributed to the slowness of learning. So I do think with respect to school closures in particular, but a lot of these other measures as well, there could have been much more learning that took place. I think it was worse here than in Europe. I think we're more polarized in various ways. 2020 was an election year. Donald Trump was on the ballot. You know, once he started pushing for the reopening of the economy, I think that became coded in a very partisan way, and that played a major role as well, that inhibited our capacity to, you know, have a sober, rational discussion of costs as well as benefits, and to try to deal with some of these issues in a way that was, you know, evidence-driven, according to accumulating evidence.
Yeah, I remember it well. And, you know, it's funny. At the very beginning, I remember that some of the people banging the drum loudest for us to get serious about this thing were actually on the right. I believe that Steve Bannon's podcast, War Room, began then as War Room Pandemic. In any event, that's what it was obsessed with. I remember him saying, Trump's got to bring the hammer down. I believe Tucker Carlson was singing the same tune. But you were getting a lot of that from the right, but not only from the right, pressure on Trump to finally do something. And then I remember he had some kind of big, like, press conference or something where he seemed to be finally, okay, I'm talking about this. I'm serious. And then it's not totally clear to me the dynamics by which there was this shift. And although, you know, although he was really the one behind a number of the policies that are now viewed with tremendous disdain from the right, it increasingly became the case that the policies that you raised questions about were being questioned from the right. So it's a pivot I don't totally understand. I do understand how in America today, if there's a given policy that's associated with Trump, that settles the matter.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats are going to be against it.
Right.
It really is almost that bad.
Yes.
But it was a weird early dynamic.
No, I think that's right. I believe that he criticized Brian Kemp when Brian Kemp started opening the economy. I think there was a lot of moving around the way just as you said. I think going back to Ebola, I'm certainly speculative, but I pretty much remember then. I think that the Republicans were in favor of much tougher sort of border closures in respect to Ebola, perhaps. So I think you're right about that. I don't have the details at my fingertips, but I think what you're saying is correct.
Yeah, I think Bannon may have seen it as lumped it in with threats from China in general.
Yes,
and of course,
yes.
those always get his attention. Now, on the masks, first of all, there's an interesting that's always seemed to me that something that's inherently hard to get to the bottom of in terms of how effective they are, because even if you do a controlled experiment, and some people finally did, I think, where they would randomly assign one group to wear masks in the course of their daily lives, you still have a situation where you know whether you're wearing a mask or not,
right.
And it could well be the case that if you're not wearing a mask, you keep more of a distance than you would if you were wearing a mask. So you can well imagine that there is some efficacy, but it doesn't show up in a study like that. That said, at the very beginning, Fauci was saying, don't bother with masks, right?
No, in fact, in 2019, I have there's a wonderful clip of he's speaking to an interviewer online in 2019, and the interviewer asks him, what should we do in the event of another pandemic? Should we wear masks? And Fauci immediately interrupts and says, no, avoid the paranoid stuff. Get a good night's sleep, eat healthy, don't drink too much, get some exercise, just do the normal healthy things.
That's pre-COVID?
That's pre-COVID, yes, pre-COVID in 2019, just shortly before. I'm forgetting the name of the doctor that interviewed him, but yes, that's available on YouTube. And the messaging varied quite a lot. Some of it was, of course, worries about mask shortages, but the studies have always been weak on this. I mean, the surgical masks and so on are not designed to prevent virus transmission, not designed to prevent respiratory viruses. We have a chapter on the mask controversy, and it is remarkable to see how people sort of misrepresented the evidence and to some degree on both sides. I had a colleague who I was talking to about this, and I sort of sent him a draft of the chapter, and he said, "Why do you want to go down this rabbit hole?" And then, you know, we talk about the warring op-eds by Brett Stevens and my colleague Zeynep Tufekci, And he said, well, I want Bret Stevens to tell a surgeon the next time he has surgery, don't bother with a surgical mask. Well, very funny, but surgical masks are not to prevent the spread of viruses. They're so you don't have blood splattered in your face or you just sneeze in the wound and so on. And in fact, the boxes of those surgical masks will often say on them, not for preventing respiratory viruses. In Australia, you could be fined for claiming that those masks would prevent respiratory virus transmission. You know, so the N95s may have had some efficacy, but who wore those N95s tight-fitted, you know, with a nose clip?
My family, my family is me and three people who were, I was concerned about the thing, but they were more concerned than I was, and I complied with their instructions, and one of them was, you wear an N95 on an airplane and you keep it tight. But no, I take your point, and in fact, I think the official recommendations or mandates, in some cases, you tell me, but in deemed a cloth mask sufficient, and yet almost nobody thought a cloth mask was going to be highly effective, right?
No, you're quite right. Yes, it included cloth masks, and part because they didn't want people wearing the surgical masks or the N95s, which were in short supply and so on. So that's absolutely correct. And actually, when Dr. Fauci was asked a few months ago, were the mask recommendations wrong and so on? And he said, oh, no, they weren't wrong. If you wore N95 tightly, it would have some efficacy. Well, the recommendations included cloth masks, as you say. So that was, I think it became a visible symbol. Actually, Dr. D.A. Henderson, who we talk about, who was also a skeptic, he was one of the people responsible for the, was often credited to be the individual most responsible for the eradication of smallpox. So he was a sort of major figure in the 50s, 60s, 70s. But back in the, I think in the 1990s, did a podcast online with a Canadian public health official talking about future pandemics and what the public health recommendation should be. And one of these things they said was, well, the public is going to want to be told something to do. We need to tell them to do something. And one of his comments was, well, if people tell them to wash their hands and maybe wear a mask, that'll make people feel better and so on. So I don't know. I think some of it ran along those lines. I mean, some of those non-pharmaceutical reports do say there's a mechanistic plausibility to masks working. I mean, insofar as it's droplets and so on. What the studies have said is that while there's no good evidence for it, and just as you say, randomized trials, well, there's some mechanistic plausibility. Fair enough. We still lack evidence for the effectiveness of these things. The studies are hard to do. They did try to do two studies, including one in Bangladesh that involved 300,000 people. There were two villages of about 150,000 people each, and one was distributing masking, but also instructions and other kinds of measures. And as you indicate, many things might be going along with that. You give people masks, you tell them to wear a mask, maybe they'll engage in more social distancing as well, so you don't really know what's going on there. But in any case, in another village without the intervention, there was a modest difference between the two, but we found, and now it's been acknowledged, that in fact the study was corrupted by a few people dropping out from one of the sample sizes. And so actually, one of my colleagues discovered in page 27 of the technical appendix that the authors admitted that the results were not significant. That was one of the studies that was cited by Dr. Tofexian, arguing that the science is clear that masks work, but that was not the case. And another Danish study, likewise, turned out not to have significant results. So, I've had other friends and colleagues here who have said the Cochrane reviews are not worth the paper they're printed on, basically, and that we need to consider a much wider range of evidence. But what we argue throughout is not that the data proves that none of these interventions work. What we argue is that the data cannot allow us to, the way my co-author puts it, reject the null hypothesis. The data is consistent with there being no effect. That doesn't mean we prove that there's no effect, but we can't prove that there was a positive effect on mortality and serious outcomes. There just is an absence of data to vindicate the effectiveness of these non-pharmaceutical measures.
Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that the policies might have other consequences that are negative, you might then, not err on the side of caution normally, right. When there's a pandemic and the evidence is ambiguous, I might say, well, why not err on the side of caution? But in with certain kinds of things where the consequences in other realms could be quite negative, there's an answer to that question. And I think you would say that with school closures in particular, compared to, say, mask mandates, right? I assume you would say that the bad consequences, the bad side effects, are more concerning with school closures than with mask mandates.
Yes, I think I would say that. I mean, mask mandates, you know, especially for kids communicating and so on. But in general, mm-hmm. you know, making facial contact matters. But yeah, I would say the school closures. But you know, a lot of the business closures also had, you know, mm-hmm. very bad impacts on people. Small firms, mom and pop stores, and so on. Social isolation also has, but you're quite right. We couldn't regard these measures simply as, you know, an effort to do what we could, you know, in a very bad situation. We really had to think about the negative costs as well. And that's something that's very strongly emphasized in those pre-COVID pandemic planning documents. Make the public aware of the costs of these measures. You know, I think we quote Andrew Cuomo in the book, who had the news conferences that got him a special Emmy Award because he was kind of the anti-Trump. He seemed to be rational and certainly had a kind of take charge attitude, as it were. You know, he said, if everything we do in terms of these restrictions saves just one life, that will be worth it, without paying the slightest bit of attention to the other side of the ledger. So in effect, we focused on the speculative hoped for benefits of these measures, but never adequately weighed the costs. And that does seem to be very widely acknowledged now, including by the few people who are criticizing our book in some ways. They at least acknowledge that no, the costs were never fully considered. So I think that's true. And certainly the school closures are the ones that seem to have had, you know, quite being widely acknowledged as having dramatic effects.
That are documented.
Yeah, 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 because of all the testing and so on. And dropout rates were a third higher than they were. The crime rate in cities seems to be associated now with the school closures, not the protests around George Floyd. And various other measures, but yes, the school closures in particular, yeah.
I remember Cuomo being a little performative about this.
Yeah.
You remember the like nightly little kind of almost show he did?
Yeah.
He had his little uniform with the official looking badge on the, you know, and there was something in the background indicating his gravitas or something.
Yes.
I don't know. It was
state seal and flag.
Yeah,
I remember him sitting at a table talking about his mother and so on. And anyway, yeah, there was definitely a theatrical quality to it, which in general is fine. It's just the substance of the message, you know, was strictly speaking irrational. And then he was celebrated for that, for doing everything possible to reduce one indice and to pay no attention. I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing that Francis Collins has now said he regrets in retrospect. That we quote at the beginning of the book, he calls it the public health mindset. And this is, you know, the head of the National Institutes of Health. He said, we had a public health mindset going into the pandemic, which was to focus entirely on reducing deaths from COVID and to pay no attention to whether things like the school closures, and I'm basically quoting here, you know, totally disrupted children's lives in a way they would never recover from. That's a public health mindset, and we were guilty of that. That does seem to be the case.
And in fact, all of Trump's expert advisors were medical people, right? Scientists.
Yes.
None of them were the kinds of like social scientists, education specialists, none of that.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right about that. There's definitely the case that the narrow subject matter experts, in public health, epidemiology and so on, Deborah Birx, so I've read her memoir, of course, Dr. Fauci and so on. And this is very important. You know, in the UK, when they did this 2011 report, and we've talked to a sociologist, Robert Dingwall, who was involved in that, he makes the point that they made a point then of making sure there was not a majority of virologists on it. In fact, he said that they might have kept them off altogether, epidemiologists. It was included a broad base of social scientists, medical people, and made sure they had diverse expertise. That Institute of Medicine letter that I talked about, again, they didn't include just medical scientists. Richard Zeckhauser was on it, who was an economist at Harvard And, you know, that sort of thing was crucial. Of course, when, you know, when the Treasury Secretary or someone, you know, made remarks about the importance of reopening the economy, then that got cast as dollars versus lives, you know. And so that was, in a way, that was that concern was minimized, not in terms of human well-being, but just dollars.
Yeah, I remember that. That reminds me of how tangible the pressure was to not say anything that would get you vilified, or at least I felt it. Maybe I was too sensitive to it, but I remember, you know, I was putting out a newsletter then as I am now, and there were a couple moments I remember, and one of them was when I think I went ahead and said it, but, you know, I said, you know, sometimes dollars are lives. I mean, you know, you at the margins, there are people actually die from bad economic times.
Yeah.
They don't have health insurance. They don't get treated for something they would otherwise get treated for. But I remember how perilous it felt to say something like that.
Yes.
And I especially, go ahead.
No, you're right. And you know, unemployment, periods of unemployment have measurable, predictable impacts on longevity and well-being. So yes, unemployment is something that has significant lifelong effects.
Now, to what extent, if any, do you think there was a socioeconomic bias in the sense that a lot of the people making the decisions were better positioned to withstand the consequences of the recommended policies than some other parts of America?
Yeah, we definitely think that there was a bit of class bias. You know, one third of American workers had to keep working right on through the pandemic in person to process the food, to transport the food, to stock the food, to deliver the food, to deliver the wine, and keep the electricity on, the utilities, essential workers, and so on. So one third of the workforce kept working. You know, we, of course, were holding them at arm's length because of the social distancing and so on. But I don't think their situation was particularly focused on. It's one of the reasons why perhaps these non-pharmaceutical measures didn't work as well as some people had hoped, is partly because one third of the workforce had to keep working in person. Also, there were no special provisions made for the vulnerable members of that class. There were general economic supports for income and I think restrictions on foreclosures and so on, but no special provisions made for them. So I do think that's the case. You know, one of the things that others have pointed out is that we couldn't have pursued these policies 25, 30 years ago because not enough commerce was online. We just didn't have the, you know, the technical wherewithal for as many people as could were able to work online, work remotely, and I guess, you know, to some extent, study remotely as well. So I think technology that has developed recently has sort of enabled that. And I do think some of this was invisible. Again, you know, Francis Collins has kind of acknowledged in this really quite excellent, only sort of gets part of the way there, but this Braver Angels event that he did in July 2023, which we quote in the book. And he says that, you know, when we were making these decisions, we were thinking of Washington and New York and Chicago. We weren't really thinking of rural areas and, you know, other parts of the country. And I suspect they were also thinking mainly of their colleagues and, you know, other people like them. And not so much of the entire range of people in the workforce. And of course, again, all of those people that I mentioned, the essential workers, their kids couldn't go to school, and they somehow had to cope with that. They would have more contact then with probably extended family members, perhaps, who would engage in childcare and so on. If both parents are working, someone has to be available to take care of the kids if both parents are essential workers. So, I do think there was a class bias. I mean, the way that some others have put it, that it was the alternative policy was focused protection on the vulnerable rather than keep the, you know, close down the entire economy and schools and so on. But some people have said that what you could say the policy we did pursue was focused protection for the laptop class, while others kept working to support us in our socially distanced online work and so on.
Yeah. Now, on the school closures, a point I think you make is that, you know, increasingly as the thing wore on, you started to see a divergence between red states and blue states in terms of policies like school closures. And yet, I believe you're saying that, and yet there was, you don't see a significant difference in mortality rate between red and blue until you get the vaccine and you have a much lower vaccine uptake rate in red states on average, and correspondingly a higher mortality rate in red states. Is that, have I got that right so far, first of all?
Completely correct. I mean, just my co-author did the data analysis on this, but using CDC data, on the 50 states and various studies of the stringency of lockdown measures, including school closures. Oxford did this very nice index of all of the non-pharmaceutical measures, and they kind of rate governments around the world. But yes, we found a significant partisan tilt to the length and stringency of school closures and other measures, with Democratic states staying closed much longer than Republican states, but no divergence in mortality until vaccines became available.
Not at all. There was no significant
divergences. And this is also true in Europe. There are very good studies of the 29 states of Europe, which diverged even more than the United States. The best one is by Pizzato et al. It's an excess mortality study looking at, you know, all cars excess mortality based on a 10-year pre-COVID average. They find no difference in mortality. Surprisingly, the authors say, you know, surprisingly, we see no differences in mortality across the 3 years of the pandemic, across the 29 states of Europe as well, which diverged also very, very widely from one another. So, mm-hmm. so there is an absence of evidence to show across the world systematically. People will pick out, well, what about this case? What about that case? There's an absence of evidence to show systematically that the lockdown measures had measurable effects on mortality.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned this policy of focused protection. One document that advocated that was called the Great Barrington Declaration, which came out in October. So this is, I don't know, like of 2020, so
October
like 9
4th,
months
yep.
into the pandemic or something, yep. or 10, 11. This is another, you know, the idea was you do, like older people, yes, you're very careful about older people, certainly nursing homes and so on. But aside from that, you live normal life. And immunity will spread as more and more people get the disease, and almost none of them die because they are not the at-risk populations. They're older people and various, you know, specifically vulnerable people who have various maladies. You'd be careful about them. This is another time when I most distinctly remember the pressure of public opinion.
Yeah.
So I think these guys wrote an op-ed in the New York Times or something. I'm not sure. I saw it somewhere, and I was putting out a newsletter. I was going to write this thing, like, interesting idea. I didn't even think I was, like, planning to really embrace it. But, you know, it wasn't crazy.
No.
And I remember, and I don't remember whether in the end I chickened out and didn't write anything or just phrased it more cautiously. I don't remember what the consequence of this, but I remember the moment when the authors of this thing were being vilified, like, as if they were bad people.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
And, you know, it was not an inherently inhumane argument. I mean,
no.
If you accept their assumptions and their expectation about the consequences, it's a humane outcome, you know. But do you remember the intensity of that?
Yes. Yes. We discuss it in the book. Francis Collins, they published on October 4th. They had a bunch of signatories, including from Mike Levitt, who's a Nobel Prize winner at Stanford, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people sort of signed on to it because it was one of these online things, a very short document, just one page. And we have, you know, the emails from Francis Collins, you know, in private. We have a lot of freedom of information requests have revealed a lot of very valuable stuff around this whole story. But, you know, he said, you know, that the op-ed or the statement from the three fringe epidemiologists is getting a lot of attention. There needs to be a quick and devastating takedown. And he emails us to various people, and this is the most powerful, you know, funder of science research in the world. The National Institutes of Health budget is $45 billion. I think that's another aspect of the story here, is we've had a very unitary funding model in the United States with vast amounts of resources being given out by one agency and its subsidiaries. And that, I think, also has played a role here. But, you know, and then he called them fringe epidemiologists in the Washington Post the next day and said it's dangerous, they're going to take lives. You know, they were widely condemned that if we followed their advice, that it would lead to 100,000 more deaths and so on. So rather than a debating point, it was that, no, they were widely condemned. And, you know, we actually quote some Twitter messages, which are public by public health people, you know, dropping F-bombs about them and so on. And you know, others have said that they certainly felt, you can imagine, that more people like junior faculty members or younger faculty members or, you know, people on university faculties where there's a lot of, you know, sort of peer comment on one another. And so I do think that what they were making was a perfectly reasonable point that, frankly, lots of people were saying in March 2020, when we started the lockdowns. We quote in the book Michael Osterholm, Tom Frieden, a variety of scientists around the United States said these measures are unlikely to work, these lockdown measures. They're going to be very costly. The best strategy is probably to focus protection on the vulnerable and allow most people to go about their business, the ones that are not vulnerable to the disease. So this was commonsensical what they were saying pre-COVID, but also in March at the beginning of COVID. And by the time they're writing this in October, the schools are still closed in democratic states. Schools have been reopened in Europe, as we mentioned before. So there's plenty of evidence about that and the harms. Now, one thing that someone has, you know, pushed back on us, we haven't talked to him directly, but one thing that Michael Osterholm has said is that, well, by October, the vaccines were on the horizon. Yeah, March, it was good to point out that these measures were unlikely to work and they were going to be very costly. But by October, the vaccines were on the rise, and that was the wrong time to reopen. At that point, we should have waited for the vaccines because they were, well, fine, but the schools were closed through the whole academic year in a lot of places. It was many months before kids went back.
That's strange, it seems. In retrospect, like, once the vaccines are out there, you would think a lot of people would say, you know, the argument for these closures is now significantly weaker.
Yeah, but, yeah. It's no, look, I agree with you. I think, you know, those it was Jay Bhattacharya, Martin Kulldorff from, you know, Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, Martin Kulldorff from Harvard, and Sunitra Gupta from Oxford, eminent people, very well established, you know, making an argument, that reminding us of the cost of these measures, the presence of alternative strategies. They made mistakes about various things, as everyone did, but they were respectable people making a respectable argument and deserved more of a more respectable hearing. And the other aspect of this was Dr. Scott Atlas, who was working in the Trump administration, Hoover Institution at Stanford, had published 5 textbooks on public health. He was condemned by the Stanford faculty. They took out a formal censure motion against Scott Atlas, and the faculty senate at Stanford voted a censure motion for him straying out of his lane and not sticking to his disciplinary expertise and defying the consensus of the establishment. Mm-hmm. And the professors who brought this censure motion against Atlas for straying out of his lane and not following the consensus in science included 2 professors of performance and theater studies. And there was one who was a psychologist, but others, and the faculty senate at Stanford, you know, was certainly straying out of their lane by doing this. But in any case, he also was talking about the cost of school closures, the ineffectiveness of requiring children and, you know, young children to wear masks and so on. So I do think there was intolerance of dissent. There was the way we call it premature moralization of disagreement. You know, reasonable disagreements that should have been discussed were moralized, some ways cast as misinformation. And this continued for quite a long time where, you know, perfectly reasonable claims were coded as misinformation. And we now know that the social media companies were contacting, or federal officials were contacting social media companies who were deboosting messages algorithmically that took positions that were dissenting and boosting messaging that supported government policy. This was in secret. You talked to a friend of mine, a professor up at Harvard who works on education policy, and he said that in sort of like April or May 2020, early on, he studies schools. So he wrote a piece for a journal and, you know, pointing out that we have evidence from teacher strikes and blizzards, you know, from the past about the damage that would be done to children from extended school closures. And you just wrote a piece saying, look, we really need to be thinking about the costs of these school closures for children. And he said the journal disappeared from the internet at that point at which they published the article. And I think this was probably an example of an algorithmic deboosting in response to him taking a position that it was at odds with the preferred narrative. And that was even, you know, before Biden came in.
Yeah. You mentioned Jay Bhattacharya. I have to file a complaint about his recent behavior, you know, partly because it is relevant to the whole question of how politics plays out in these contexts. So now he's what, director of the National Institutes of Health?
Yes. Succeeded Francis Collins. Yeah.
And so I guess at RFK Jr.'s behest, who is his boss, right? RFK Jr. is his boss. I think the NIH is within the Department of Health and Human Services.
I believe that's the case as well, yeah.
So, you know, RFK Jr., I guess, is the reason that they pulled all the money out of mRNA research, right, or something like that. I may get the details wrong, but there was a big withdrawal of research funds. And Jay Bhattacharya wrote an op-ed defending it, basically, and he said, and it was kind of like, well, you know, it's not that, who knows? He didn't deny that mRNA stuff could be useful. Well, I'm glad, because that's what was behind the COVID vaccine, yeah, which manifestly saved a lot of lives in the United States. I'm glad to hear you're not claiming that it's of no value. He says, but the public has lost confidence in it. Well, yeah. And look, you can blame, there are certainly Democrats you can blame for that. But Jay, you can blame a lot of your friends for it, including your boss, for the loss of confidence. And in any event, is it not your job, given your position, to just speak the goddamn truth and tell people, look, this is very valuable stuff. We know for sure that there are Americans, by the way, a lot of them in red states, who would be alive but are dead because of the vaccine skepticism during COVID. I mean, that, look, it's not like it's exceptionally pathetic behavior. You know, we all are very responsive to career pressures and so on. And you could say he had to almost say this or resign. Who knows? But I'm sorry. I'm not happy about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that. And I do remember that aspect of the article, the loss of public trust. To the extent that there was an argument to be made, it should, I think, have been based entirely on the merits. If public trust diverges from that, then science and public health officials and government should be being clearer about the merits. Not bowing to the lack of public trust. So I don't disagree with what you're saying about that that particular op-ed. They did say they're continuing it for cancer research, I think, mRNA research, and I think it's part of a review process. But I'm not going to argue with you on that score.
Okay, I just didn't want us to be agreeing too
much.
No,
fair enough. But I'm sorry to agree with you.
Yeah, really. I was expecting better of you. Okay, so listen, as you know, Steve, what we do on the podcast is generally do much, usually, you know, in fact, most of the conversation in public. And then we go into something called Overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which it's easy to become. There's a link in the show notes, you can just Google Non-Zero Substack. And then once you've done that, you can set up a podcast feed that always gives you the overtimes without going into any special trouble. But before we go into overtime, I want to give you a chance. First of all, I want to repeat the name of the book, In COVID's Wake, How Our Politics Failed Us. It's gotten a lot of attention. They must be pretty happy at Princeton University Press, right? Their books don't always wind up at the center of public discourse. Just because they're an academic press.
Of course. No, we've been delighted, and also delighted that a lot of, you know, kind of mainstream progressive institutions have taken it seriously. PBS NewsHour, New York Times, and mm-hmm. so on. So, no, we've been delighted, and I think the press is delighted. So, absolutely, yeah.
Also, congratulations. I learned in the course of doing online research today that, and you may already know this, but it says that Stephen Macedo was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2013. You were aware of that, presumably?
I was, yes.
Congratulations. That's quite an honor.
Well, I guess so. I have a colleague who said something like, I shouldn't say this on the air, but he did said, I won't name who it was, said half the people that deserve to be in that organization are in it, and half the people who are in it deserve it. So anyway,
did he tell you which one you were?
No, but I think he meant I was in the other. I was in the wrong half, probably. But anyway, no. Anyway, thank you, Bob.
So is there anything else you want to say?
Well, yeah, I'll just say a couple of quick things, which is, you know, you focused on core themes. You know, I wanted the subtitle of the book to be How Our Institutions Failed Us, and our editor thought that was too boring. And since the book's done well, maybe it turns out he was correct. But we do focus on, you know, what we think are the what are supposed to be the truth-seeking departments of liberal democracy, universities, you know, journalism, and science. And we a big part of the kind of a theme that runs through it, and it's sort of implicit in a lot of things we've been talking about, is that, you know, there's just the people that are supposed to be seeking the truth and in an objective, nonpartisan way, just have not been doing their jobs as well as they should under the influences of, you know, groupthink. I think the class biases you've talked about, but also, you know, being infected by this polarized environment. And I think we find even now that there are some people that are highly resistant to some of the arguments we're making. You know, because I think it sort of is seen as critical of the blue states and maybe blue state policymakers in particular. And it's certainly not our intention to engage in any kind of partisan finger pointing, but just to engage in some self criticism. Another thing people have said to us: are you worried that the book came out at a time when Trump is attacking universities and science and so on? He might seem to be giving aid and comfort. And you know, we believe in science and universities. But we do think that the premise of those attacks is that they're politicized, and the only way to sort of defy that premise is to try to be as self-critical as possible, and to in order to strengthen these institutions. So I'll just make those comments, and the only other thing I'll say is that maybe we'll talk about it in the overtime part. But there is also, you know, this concern about people telling the truth just straightforwardly. The origins of the virus is one aspect of that. You know, the idea that was coded as a conspiracy theory early on is just absurd. There's certainly more than a whiff of scandal associated with the way that subject matter has been treated. And it's important because this gain of function research continues to go on. New labs are being founded around the world to do gain of function research, which has been extremely controversial. The functions that are gained is transmissibility and virulence. And there are real questions as to whether government should be funding this or allowing this research at all. And I'll just say, you know, we have a chapter on this in the book, but there's now good evidence that the U.S. government was funding the research in the Wuhan lab on bat coronaviruses. There was a lot of obfuscation, at the very least, that has taken place subsequently on that subject. So I do think that's another aspect of the book and another place where science journalists have not pursued the questions with the seriousness which they deserve. And universities, unfortunately, are not, just have conferences, workshops, research on these kinds of questions in a way that's sort of surprising, given that this is the biggest global crisis since World War II and the worst pandemic in a century. It was an all of society response. And there's a kind of, there's more silence around many of these issues than there ought to be. Anyway, those are some of the larger themes of the book. We've been happy with the response, and happy also that people find it a well-written book, which we tried to do to make it readable and accessible.
Yeah, it is. I do want to, in fact, the first thing I want to talk about in overtime is the question of the origins of the pandemic, lab leak versus zoonotic, and the possible role that people in the scientific establishment, including the government, may have played in discouraging objective inquiry into that from early on. And I hope we'll have time to get into the politics more broadly. We kind of touched on that, but obviously, the whole thing was shaped by, the polarized nature of America these days. So anyway, thanks everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime. In any event, buy the book In COVID's Wake, and after that, rate and review the Non-Zero Podcast.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Here we go into overtime.